Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Interpol issued a red notice Thursday for former Nissan car company chairman Carlos Ghosn. The notice is a request to law enforcement agencies around the world to arrest a wanted person. Ghosn faces charges of financial wrongdoing in Japan. His sudden arrival in Lebanon on Monday, after a stop in Turkey, shocked officials in Japan and raised questions around the world. The former Nissan chief was set to go on trial in April. He was permitted to stay at home under supervision after posting a $14 million bail. Ghosn said in a statement that he had fled Japan to avoid political persecution in a rigged Japanese justice system. Ghosn is often credited with helping French carmaker Renault and Japan's Nissan recover from near bankruptcy. He is a national hero to many people in Lebanon. That country's justice minister, Albert Sirhan, told the Associated Press that Lebanon will carry out its duties. But he said that Lebanon has not received an official extradition request from Japan. And he noted that the two countries do not have an extradition treaty. Sirhan added that Ghosn entered Lebanon on a legal passport and there is no charge against Ghosn in Lebanon. Born in Brazil to Lebanese parents and educated in France, Ghosn holds passports from all three countries. How Ghosn managed to flee Japan is still a mystery to many, including his own lawyers and officials in Japan and Turkey. Airline flight data suggest Ghosn traveled on two different planes, one from Japan to Turkey and another from Turkey to Lebanon. The Turkish newspaper Hürriyet reported that a plane carrying Ghosn landed at Istanbul's airport on the morning of December 29th. Ghosn did not register upon landing and left on another plane for Lebanon. Turkey's state-run Anadolu agency said Thursday that Turkish officials had detained seven people in connection with Ghosn's escape. A Turkish police spokesperson said the seven included four pilots and three airport workers. The Reuters news agency reported that all seven were expected to give statements in court on Thursday. In Japan, officials entered Ghosn's home in Tokyo on Thursday to look for evidence. The search went on as government offices in Japan are still closed this week for the New Year holiday. Ghosn's lawyers in Japan said they had no knowledge of his escape and they had all three of his passports. Japanese public broadcaster NHK TV, however, reported that Ghosn had a second French passport. Ghosn was first arrested in Japan in November 2018. He faces four charges of financial wrongdoings, including hiding his earnings through payments to car businesses in the Middle East. At the time of his arrest, Ghosn was head of both Renault and Nissan automobile companies. He said Japanese officials created false charges against him to try to stop a possible merger between Nissan and Renault. On Thursday, Ghosn tried to distance his family from any part of his escape. He called reports that his family was involved with his leaving Japan false and misleading. "I alone organized my departure," Ghosn said.
Rwanda is aiming to provide free medicine to all its citizens who suffer from pain caused by life-threatening illnesses. The country is leading efforts to produce the painkiller morphine locally. That would mean the country would not have to depend on costly opioid medicines sold by large companies. Experts say large drug companies cannot make a lot of money selling low-cost generic morphine to the poor and dying in countries like Rwanda. Most people in sub-Saharan Africa do not have the money to pay for costly opioids like oxycodone and fentanyl. About 90% of opioids are used by people in the world's richest nations, where just 17% of the world's population lives. Those estimates come from the International Narcotics Control Board, or INCB. Most users of opioids are in the United States, Canada, Western Europe, and Australia. In much of the world, a rise in opioid prescriptions began in 1997, INCB data examined by the Associated Press shows. Since then, opioid use worldwide has increased by 3. The rise led to a massive increase in opioid addiction in the world's wealthiest countries. However, this rise in painkillers only involved costly opioid products that became very profitable for large drug companies, INCB data showed. The use of morphine, which costs far less and is considered one of the most dependable painkillers, remained flat. Morphine produced by large manufacturers costs, in general, 6 times more in many low- and middle-income nations than in wealthy ones, the INCB reports. Experts say this is partly because small countries with low opioid usage rates are not in a position to negotiate prices with drug companies. A major study by the Lancet Commission on Global Access to Palliative Care and Pain Relief recently examined the inequality between rich and poor countries. The study estimated that it would cost just $145 million a year to provide enough morphine to ease end-of-life suffering around the world. Yet millions still suffer without pain medication in the poorest places. So a growing number of African countries, including Rwanda, Kenya, and Malawi, have begun to make and give out morphine on their own. The efforts generally include cooperative activities between governments and nonprofit organizations. "Pain is torture," said Diane Mukasahaha, who leads Rwanda's national effort for palliative care. She told the AP she had seen patients without morphine nearly starve to death because they were too sick to eat. "People should have medication like an American person. We are all human beings. The body is the same." I'm Brian Lynn.
The new year can come on different dates for different cultures. Most of the Western world, for example, celebrates it on January 1st. This year, the Lunar New Year takes place on January 25th. The Persian New Year, Nowruz, falls on March 20th. And the Islamic New Year is August 19th. But one thing many cultures have in common is the idea of New Year's resolutions. A New Year's resolution is a personal goal to change unwanted behavior, make a life improvement, or try something new. Popular New Year's resolutions in the United States, for example, include losing weight, improving your finances, volunteering for a charity, and spending less time on social media. On today's Everyday Grammar, we will show you how to talk about resolutions in English. First, let's learn how to ask people about their resolutions. Listen to a short conversation.
Hey there, Jill. Happy New Year. Great to see you.
Hi, Jonathan. Happy New Year to you, too. How was yours?
It was crazy. We went to New York and watched the ball drop in Times Square. Really crowded and loud, but still really fun.
Sweet. Do you have any New Year's resolutions?
Jill asked Jonathan about resolutions simply by saying, "Do you have any New Year's resolutions?" You can also say, "What are your New Year's resolutions?" to ask about more than one, or "What is your New Year's resolution?" to ask about one. Now, let's find out how to answer the question. When we make statements about our resolutions, we often use phrasal verbs. We can use the phrasal verb take up to say that we will start a new activity as a hobby. Listen to Jill and Jonathan continue their conversation.
Sweet. Do you have any New Year's resolutions?
Yes, I do. I plan to take up kickboxing starting next week. I'm excited to finally do it rather than just talk about it. How about you?
Another phrasal verb for resolutions is give up, which is to stop doing or using something. We can use this verb to talk about ending bad habits or changing a behavior for a time. Let's hear Jill respond by using the verb give up.
How about you?
I'm giving up sugar for the month of January. Then for the rest of the year, I'm avoiding soft drinks.
Impressive. I wish I could join you, but kickboxing class starts soon. I'll probably want a sweet snack after class.
Another phrasal verb, cut out, has the same basic meaning as give up. For example, Jill could say, "I am cutting out sugar for the month of January." But in many situations, we do not need phrasal verbs to talk about resolutions, as you will soon see. Next, let's talk about verb tenses and forms. Jonathan talked about his new kickboxing hobby using the verb plan, followed by the infinitive verb form. And Jill talked about giving up sugar using the present continuous verb tense, also called be plus ing. We can also use the simple future tenses, one with will and the other with going to. These tenses are especially useful when the new year has not come yet. Imagine it's the last week of the year, and a few people are talking to each other about resolutions. Here are some things you might hear.
In 2020, I'm going to visit my parents every month.
By January 1st, I will end a few unhealthy friendships.
In the new year, I'm going to walk 10,000 steps every day.
When we use simple future tenses to talk about resolutions, we're expressing that we are making a promise to or plan for ourselves. The noun resolution comes from the verb resolve, which means to make a serious decision to do something. You may have noticed that the statements so far today did not actually use the word resolution. That is because the subject was already known by the listeners. But it is still perfectly normal to start your statements with, "My New Year's resolution is," or "My New Year's resolutions are." An infinitive verb or a gerund must come after these phrases. Here is an example.
My New Year's resolution is to call my sister on video chat every week.
The infinitive verb here is to call. You can also use a gerund, like this.
My New Year's resolution is calling my sister on video chat every week.
Well, that's all for today's program. Happy New Year! I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. During the 1800s, the federal government forced Native American Indians to live in special areas. These were called reservations. The Indians no longer could move freely over the Great Plains to hunt buffalo. White men were settling there. The situation resulted in violence. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of these Western wars.
The government sent soldiers to force the Indians to move to reservations. But the soldiers could not keep them there. Groups of Indians would leave the reservations in the spring. They followed the buffalo across the plains. Some raided the homes of white settlers. They stole horses and cattle. At the end of the summer, the Indians would return to the reservations, and the government would give them food for the winter.
As years passed, fewer Indians left the reservations to live the old life on the plains. It became difficult to find buffalo. The plains were becoming empty. Only a few years before, millions of buffalo lived on the Great Plains. Then railroads were built across the country. White men came to claim the grasslands. They put up fences. Cowboys came up from Texas with huge groups of cattle. They forced the buffalo away or killed them. The Indians tried to prevent this killing. Angry groups of Indians often attacked white buffalo hunters. But the army was too strong. Soldiers killed or captured many Indians. Finally, most Indians gave up the struggle. They surrendered their guns and horses. They went back to the reservations and became farmers.
All this was taking place in what is now the south central part of the United States. Far to the north, another struggle was taking place involving the Great Sioux Indian tribe. The Sioux had signed a treaty with the government in 1868. The treaty gave them a large reservation in what is now Nebraska, South Dakota, and Wyoming. The Black Hills in Dakota were part of the reservation. These hills were important to the Sioux. In their religion, the Black Hills were a holy place. They were the center of their world, where the gods lived. They were the place where Indian fighters went to speak with the Great Spirit.
In 1873, the Black Hills suddenly became important to white men, too. Gold was discovered there. Treaties and religion meant nothing to the white miners who rushed to the Black Hills to search for gold. At first, the Indians killed some of the miners. They chased others away. But more miners came. The Sioux tribe asked the government to enforce the treaty. Tribal leaders asked the government to keep white men away from the reservation. The army sent soldiers to remove the miners. The soldiers ordered the miners to leave, but they made no effort to enforce the order. Again, the Indians protested. This time, the government sent officials to negotiate a new treaty. It asked the Sioux Indians to give up the Black Hills. Some of the Indian leaders refused to negotiate. One who rejected the invitation was Sitting Bull. "I do not want to sell any land to the government," Chief Sitting Bull said. He held a little dust between his fingers. "Not even this much."
This resistance did not stop government efforts to get the Black Hills for the miners. The War Department sent General George Crook to punish the Indians and force them back to their reservation. Crook led a large force into Sioux country. He surprised an Indian village, capturing hundreds of horses. There was another clash a few months later. This time, the result was very different. The Indians gave the army its worst defeat in almost a century.
The battle took place near the Little Bighorn River. General George Custer led 212 soldiers in search of the Indian leader Crazy Horse. As General Custer moved through the river valley, he sent men ahead to explore the area. His men returned with reports that thousands of Indians were waiting to attack. Custer refused to listen. He pushed forward. Soon his forces were surrounded by Indians. In less than an hour, the Indians killed the general and every one of his men. The white soldiers lay dead at Little Bighorn. And Custer's name would go down in history as a symbol of foolish pride in battle. The battle at Little Bighorn was a serious defeat for the United States Army. But the Indians' victory did not last long. Within a year, the Army forced most of the Sioux to surrender. It took the Black Hills for the miners. It moved the Indians to a new reservation.
In the next few years, the same thing happened to other Indian tribes throughout the West. under great pressure from white settlers, the government took land from the Indians and opened it to settlement. The size of Indian reservations was reduced again and again. One by one, the Indian tribes of the West changed. Their fierce fighters became farmers who needed government help. They were weak and broken in spirit. One Indian leader named Black Elk described the situation best. He was a survivor of a battle at a place called Wounded Knee. Many Indian women and children had died there. Years later, Black Elk said, "I did not know then how much was ended. When I look back now from this high hill of my old age, I can still see the dead lying all over the ground. And I can see that something else died there in the bloody mud and was buried. A people's dream died there."
Some Indians turned to religion during this difficult time. An Indian religious leader named Wovoka gained influence. Wovoka declared that the Great Spirit had chosen him to prepare the Indians for a new world. He said the new world would arrive soon, and it would be a wonderful world. There would be no white men, he said, and all dead Indians would come back to life. Wovoka warned that new soil would rise up and cover the world like a flood. He said Indians could escape destruction by dancing a special dance. It was called the Ghost Dance. Wovoka said the ghost dance would make Indians powerful. He said it would even protect them from bullets fired by the white men's guns.
Thousands of Indians in the American West listened to Wovoka's message. They believed him, and they began to dance for long hours every day. On the Sioux reservations, all other activities stopped. Children no longer went to school. No one did anything but dance. All this frightened white officials. They tried to arrest some Indian leaders to stop the dancing. The arrests led to fighting, and the fighting led to a final battle in which the army defeated the Indians completely. The Indian wars were over. Wovoka himself told his followers, "Our trails are covered with grass and sand. We cannot find them. Today, I call upon you to travel a new trail. It is the only trail now open, the white man's road."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.